Welcome back, everyone. We're now beginning the third and final hour of this special edition of Narsil in Action. And amazingly, we still have a lot of folks still with us. On this third hour, we're going to be talking about New Mexico. Some of you even have heard of our state. And I was going to do a prize contest winner, but I'm going to hold off a little while so that maybe you'll stick with us longer. Andy, we definitely want to have this hour for our distribution locally. Do we need to run a local tape here, or are you capturing everything?
I am capturing.
Oh, good. All right. So that's good to hear. So let me introduce our special guest for this hour, Ms. Ashley Raymore Cloud. Ms. Cloud is a former assistant district attorney with the 13th Judicial District Attorney's Office, who recently left to pursue criminal defense work, specializing in sex offender cases. She spent the better part of her 25-year legal career as a prosecutor in New Mexico. As a prosecutor, she has held positions as felony DWI supervisor, arson division supervisor, and supervisor of the DA clinical program. During her time at the 2nd, which is Albuquerque, Bernalillo County, and the 13th Judicial District Attorney's Offices, Ashley has prosecuted and tried numerous cases, including child sex crimes, murder, property crimes, drug crimes, domestic violence, escape from jail, arson, and DWIs. Ms. Cloud has also practiced law in domestic relations, criminal defense, white collar, and bankruptcy law. She has extensive technology experience in forensics, cybersecurity, knowledge management, and e-discovery as a consultant for law firms and working for various software companies. Ashley, I kind of know you, I think, personally, even though we've not met in person, and I am just so delighted that you could be with us tonight and for the relationship that we're forming with our state organization here, Liberty and Justice Coalition. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Larry, for having me.
We are excited to have someone of your caliber with the passion that you're going to have, and we're just looking forward to a lot of good things coming. So with a 25-year career in prosecution, the listeners are going to know why. Can we trust this person? Why are you coming on to the defense? Is this a spy, or what the heck's going on? Are you sabotaging us?
And I would think that too, Larry, except as you've gotten to know. So a lot of the people that know me thought of me as a hardcore prosecutor when I first started prosecuting 25 years ago in Albuquerque. And at that time, I held the belief that everybody was guilty of something. Then I moved to Georgia. And I moved to Georgia in 2005 and was there until 3 years ago, 2016. And it changed my entire viewpoint on the justice system, constitutional issues, civil rights, because I became involved with somebody that is a convicted felon and is a registered sex offender. And I actually, when I first met him, did not believe a lot of the stuff that he told me. Being a prosecutor and being an attorney, I'm distrustful by nature anyways. So I went and did a whole lot of research and a lot of background. And then I've been with him for almost 9 years now and have seen firsthand how probation treats sex offenders, how the public treats sex offenders, how officers treat sex offenders. And so we relocated back to New Mexico because I have family here and I had my first grandchild, thinking that it would actually be better. And it turned out to actually be almost worse. Again, I thought, I'm only going to go into civil rights. I'm only going to do constitutional law. I'm never going to do prosecuting again. And I let somebody convince me, somebody that's a really good civil rights attorney, convince me I could do the most justice on the side of the prosecution. And for the last year and a half, that was what I attempted to do until it became clear that there were so many constitutional violations on the sex offender cases. And since I was specializing in child sex crimes, it became more and more evident that probation in particular just does not care about what the law is or what they can and cannot do. And they just do whatever they can. And they've been doing it for so long without being challenged that that's just what they're going to keep doing. So about a month ago, I finally had enough and decided I was just going to undertake spending the rest of my life to making sure this didn't happen, not just to my husband, but to other people out there. And I became more involved with people that I've known for 25 years. They're all criminal defense attorneys. And they started telling me stories. We started comparing stories. And then I started working more and more closely with you, Larry. And that's my goal from this point forward. I have a vested interest. I am extremely passionate about solving these issues, even if we can't solve them all at once, but basically starting to chip away at what we can and just keep moving forward. And that's my goal.
Well, we at Liberty and Justice Coalition, we're hoping to be the first state that has a staff attorney. We're in negotiations. We have not come to a complete and final agreement, mainly because I haven't presented what Ash and I've been discussing to the board because we haven't had a board meeting scheduled yet. But we're very optimistic that we're going to come to an agreement and we're going to have the first staff attorney in the nation working for Liberty and Justice Coalition. It'll be a part-time position with the goal that someday that we'll have adequate funding. We wouldn't even have the funding now if it weren't for a couple of generous donors that have given us a significant amount of money in the last few years. And we've been hoarding our money. And that's going to lead me to my next question. We've been hoarding our money because this case in the United States Circuit Court of Appeals called Miller versus Rankin, that case is waiting for a decision. And we feel like that we could not prudently spend those resources mounting a full throttle challenge against registration until the 10th. Either affirms or reverses Judge Mache. So can you illuminate why us holding back our fire is so important and why whether or not you feel that's prudent?
You're absolutely right, Larry, that it's a good thing to hoard the resources until then. So for those who are not in the New Mexico, Colorado district, the case Miller v. Rankin is out of Colorado, and the 10th Appellate District and 10th Circuit is actually encompassing, including New Mexico, Colorado, and several of the other surrounding states. So even if we were to go forward right now today and say, hey, we're going to litigate this issue, we would run into an issue where the judges would say, oh, well, there's already a case out there. We're just going to wait to see how they rule, and then we'll rule accordingly, and we may have wasted a lot of resources. The other roadblock would be the attorney general here, who would basically most prudently on his behalf argue that, hey, there's already a case out there. Why on earth are we even going to talk about this until this case is decided? And that case can go either way. The judge that is actually up for appellate review has died, and some of his cases have been upheld throughout the years, and very few of his cases have actually been overturned. But there's a whole bunch of nuances in this case. And so it's really, really important for us to wait and see what the 10th Circuit actually says and then move forward accordingly. Because if they rule and affirm his decision, then we've got a really strong case here. If they don't and they overrule it, then our case is that much weaker and we may have to go back to the drawing board. But we have such limited resources that as it is, I don't think it's wise for us to proceed until we have a good decision in that case.
Well, as you can imagine, being on the forefront of the leadership team, I get a lot of feedback, and it's mostly negative feedback about, why don't you people? You've been asking for money for 10 years. Why don't you people do this? And I said, well, it's just not prudent. Litigating for the sake of litigating is not a prudent thing to do. And so we have been holding our fire, but we're about to release some of that fire, which we're going to be talking about tonight on some things that we think we can litigate. While we're waiting for the 10th Circuit. And everybody wants to know, when do they have to rule? And the answer is, they don't have to rule. They don't have a particular deadline. Somebody sent me an email just a few days ago, and he said the Supreme Court's term adjourned ended on June 30th. Doesn't that apply to the circuit? I said, no, it doesn't. And so when do they have to rule, Ashley?
They don't. And it's funny that you should say that, because I'm one of the most impatient people. I think that if we certify something to the Supreme Court or the appellate court, that they should immediately jump on it and understand how important it is, because we think it's important. But for example, there's a case here, State v. Wynn, that all occurred 5 years ago, and they just now released an unpublished decision on it. So there's an incredible backlog in the Court of Appeals, and they can take as much time as they want. The attorneys, unfortunately, are stuck having to come up with deadlines to get the stuff submitted, but then it's a hurry up and wait game from that point. So I'm just as anxious as you and everybody else, but we really are just in a holding pattern until then.
Well, I hope our supporters will continue to understand that we're trying to be prudent with the very limited resources, and that's why we have not launched a full throttled attack on registration. And not to mention, we've got case law that's controlling until it's not. We've got State versus Drucktinus from 2004, and that's the last appellate review of any meaningful level where they went into registration. And of course, we didn't have version 2 or version 3 at that time. But we've tried to get back before the Supreme Court. In fact, I was an expert witness in a case out of Roswell with Johnny Valenzuela. And they refused the grant review. And that's their prerogative at the state Supreme Court level. So we've not had any traction with the state Supreme Court since Drucktinus. And that was actually not even a state Supreme Court. That was a Court of Appeals opinion. So we're not optimistic that the state Supreme Court is anxious to revisit registration.
No, they're not. And there's some turnover with some retirements and stuff. So there's been some shifting of the panels on the Supreme Court and the appellate courts here in New Mexico. So it's a little bit of a waiting game again. And anything that we can get from a higher district, from the 10th Circuit or anybody else that gives us some teeth, is going to be extremely helpful. And we want to have cases that we have that kind of bite into, because we need some wins.
Absolutely. It's called building the body of case law.
Yes.
and the body of case law is getting stronger. And when the 10th Circuit rules, if they affirm Judge Mage, that's going to build the body of case law, because you'll have the 10th and you'll have the 6th. And all the state Supreme Court decisions. But New Mexico has got some very ambitious litigation plans. And we've already filled out your calendar with more than a human can possibly do. for a half-time job. But the reason why we decided to go this direction is that we feel like that the model that we've been pursuing with trying to find an attorney that will take a case with partial payment at a very high hourly rate, even though they discount it for us, is not the most prudent way to go. It seems like to us, it's more prudent to have a person on staff that they can count on a continuation of a salary. And if you provide the basic overhead of an office, then the hourly rate that you're going to be looking at is far lower than what we can do on a contract basis. So we think that we can get the best bang for our resources is to have the person on staff. But that's going to require us to be able to win litigation, because that's going to be one way of replenishing our funds. Because as a prevailing party, when we go into federal civil rights litigation, when we use 1983 as a vehicle, we'll be able to recover those fees, those attorney's fees and those out-of-pocket costs. And we're hoping that will be a significant funder going forward, because, as you know, Ashley, what are we, 49th or 50th in per capita income here? We just don't have the ability to raise gobs of money. Plus, we have a very small offender population compared to Texas or California or even Georgia or Michigan. We have 3,700 here, and where some of these states have 10, 20, 30, 40,000, 100,000 in California. We just don't have the numbers here. So we're looking for a model that will provide a continuation of funding, which means that we're going to have to choose litigation that we think we can win at least a significant number of the cases we choose, because if we don't, we'll be broke, because the offenders are not able to keep us going. We would need to fund a part-time position. We would need $50,000 in donation a year minimum to do that, and we're nowhere near that level of donations. So let's talk about what we're going to do. The first one we have is already in the process, and it's through contract relationship we have with the Burgess and Porter law firm and with Paul Dubling, who's NARSL's general counsel in Chapel Hill. I say Raleigh, but people who don't know that Chapel Hill is right nearby. That's a declaratory judgment for people who have out-of-state convictions. Why is that important? Why are we even worried about that when you come to New Mexico? If you register in another state, why shouldn't you just go register here and quit griping?
Because the consistency and the due process is just not followed. And I mean, you see that in a lot of states. This one, I feel fairly confident that we can get a declaratory judgment for a due process mechanism, because you have people, and I think you have the numbers, Larry. I want to say that at least there's like 500 or 600 people that this affects directly right as of today, and it may be more. But these are people that basically come in here and they're just pigeonholed into stuff without any type of hearing or anything that translates into how are we going to register you? Do you have to register, or any of the other mechanisms that we really need in place? And so it's pretty important that we start with this one, even though I know there's a lot of other issues, but I think this one is actually a really good win. I think we're on pretty solid ground with prior case law and the way that some of the other states are ruling, that this could be a good one for us to start off with.
Well, and for our listeners in other states, we don't have the provision in our law that says if you have to register anywhere, you have to register here. We have a specific provision that says it has to be one of our enumerated offenses, or it has to be an equivalent from another jurisdiction. And we have case law. We have significant case law. Now we have two cases where they're clarifying what has to take place to decide if it's equivalent. So if you have to register in Georgia for making obscene phone calls to a minor, that is not equivalent to any offense that we have on our list here. Now, that doesn't say that they wouldn't tell you to register, because we don't have a due process. So if you come here and tell them you register in Georgia, they would likely tell you, well, get yourself registered here. They would take your registration and be glad to have you. But there's a due process needs to happen. And what is due process? Why isn't Regina sitting up at DPS in Santa Fe, her saying he has to register? Why isn't that due process? What's wrong with that?
Because they're not getting a fair hearing. They're not getting any potential right to counsel. They're not getting any of the rights that come with that due process. And how can you tell somebody to register for making obscene phone calls somewhere, and we don't have a statute here, when you've just got some random person going, oh, that looks like it should fit right here, and you have to register? There's absolutely no sense in that. And you're entitled to due process, especially if you're going to make somebody be on a registry. And you're also, in particular here, when you're on the registry, they send letters out, notifications out to your jobs and everything else. So there's a significant impact in this. It's not just a matter of you being on the registry and that's it. We just put you on a list and nobody looks at it again. They're still doing house raids and everything else. So it's important that you have those due process considerations.
Well, and in terms of our registry, we have a small segment of people who would not be released to the public. And if your offense were to translate to one of those offenses, it would be very important that due process be there before you're actually released to the public. Because once you're on the internet, our producer can tell us how hard it is to get rid of anything that's on the internet. So if you have an offense, if you have an equivalent offense to one of our non-publishable, non-releasable offenses, and they arbitrarily decide that you are in the other category on list E versus list D, then your life is ruined with no hope of recovery. The state's not going to pay you for your lost economic opportunity, for anything that happened to you as a result of it being incorrectly published. So that's why this is important. We have 560, at last count, people who have out-of-state offenses where they've received no due process. Some of them date back for 20 years. And they say, awaiting translation. For 20 years, they're awaiting translation. Well, we're going to help the state decide that when we find the plaintiffs we're looking for. And by the way, if you're in New Mexico and you have an out-of-state translation offense, and you're on that awaiting translation category, we'd be delighted to talk to you. So that's but we've got a list of things we'd like to do. And so let's talk about the state's failure to hold hearings as required by the statute when a parolee has served 5 years of supervision. Now, let's be clear, Ashley. They've named this parole, but it's not really parole in the sense of what parole is. In this state, you serve all of your time, less your good time, and then you go into a period of post-prison supervision that they title parole. And then you have to serve a minimum of 5 years, and then a hearing is supposed to take place. Tell me about these hearings. Do you know anything about any of them ever happening and what the outcome of them are?
So they don't, and I ran into a situation. So technically by the statute, to be clear, after the first 2.5 years, it's actually reviewable, and nobody is doing that. Nobody is bringing those. I ran into a situation as a prosecutor where I was actually instructing the judge that he had the jurisdiction and that these needed to be reviewed. And I had to talk him through it, because he's like, I don't think I can even look at anything after the first 90 days. I'm like, by statute, you have to. And what are you doing on these 5 years? they're all,
Now,
oh,
let's
we
clarify.
don't
Are we
know.
talking about probation or parole? Because I know the judge would have the authority on probation side, but we're talking about these people who are under the tyranny of the parole board. Would the judge have any authority there?
Yes, they actually do on the same thing. The chief judge and I had a long discussion about it out in Sandoval County after I informed him that he had the right to do that. But they're still, regardless of whether it's parole or probation, they're not even holding these hearings. They're just either automatically continuing them or they're attempting to violate them prior to getting that. As you all know, that we have instances where they're trying to violate them right up against the 5 years.
And of course, since parole is not what it was in 1972 when the Supreme Court addressed parole, parole in those days was a person had an indeterminate amount of sentence imposed on them, and then broad discretion was given to prison authorities to give someone a trial run if they were given a sentence of 3 to 15, and after they'd done the minimum of 3, the prison authorities could have various criteria where they would say, we're going to give this person a test run to be free, but they still owe us 17 years if they screw up the remainder of 17 years. That's not the case here. We have where you've served your whole prison time.
Right.
And then you're under here, and you have a significant liberty interest. If you're sitting in prison and you should be in the free world, that is a huge damage to you and your family. So we've not prioritized these at the board level. And once we get our attorney in the discussions, we're going to prioritize these. But these are all relatively equal in terms of priority at the moment. But I expect as we prioritize, these will come more into focus on which we're going to tackle next. The first one we talked about, on out-of-state translation, that's already underway. The next one is very dear to your heart, is the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision. It brings people into New Mexico who have convictions in other states, and they may be serving parole, they may be serving probation, they may be serving community control, they may be on community supervision for life, any type of supervision that requires reporting. Why are these probable cause hearings relevant? What's the big deal? I mean, you violate your probation, shouldn't you just go back to whatever state you were convicted in and fight it out there? Why do you guys want to make such a big production about probable cause hearings?
No, I mean, there's several reasons for that probable cause hearing. And one of the reasons that they originally did it under the Interstate Compact was, so you have somebody, since the one that we're fighting right now is, you have somebody that is in New Mexico from Georgia. They violate probation here, technical, they don't commit any new crimes. And automatically probation wants to send them back to Georgia, because why wouldn't you if you're probation here? You're like, let's get them back to the state they came from. We don't care about them. And let's get them out of our hair. But from the standpoint of the sending state, which would be Georgia, you're like, wait a minute, how do we even know they did anything? Or are we just going by what some report that some random probation officer actually just wrote? So the mechanism is in there to hold a probable cause hearing before a neutral and detached hearing officer within a reasonable amount of time close to the place that the alleged violations occurred. And part of that reason is so that that's your best shot of getting witnesses. That's your best shot of presenting a case. Because if they go through all the trouble and take you back to your sending state, in this case, Georgia, how are you supposed to present witnesses there? What are you supposed to do? Or are you already in custody and back in the sending state, and they're just going to rubber stamp whatever they did here? So you're entitled to due process. Granted, it's more limited because it's a probation revocation. It's more limited than it would be if you were initially charged with crimes. But that's not happening here. And we know it's not happening here. We know that actually what's happening is they're trying to treat it like a parole hearing, where they just have some informal hearing before an administrative officer. And even if you request counsel, they're not giving you counsel. There's a whole bunch of stuff they're not doing. And
well, I don't like you say not giving. They won't permit you to provide your own counsel. Not giving
Correct.
You counsel is different than not allowing you to have access to your own counsel. That was
good clarification.
The mistake in 72, people looked at the decisions, and the Supreme Court didn't say, ironclad, you're not allowed to have counsel. They said the state wasn't required to provide it to you because of the informality, and it was going to murky up the revocation process, because it was supposed to be encouraging prison administrators to release people. And if you bring all these attorneys in, then you're going to muddy the process. But that's not the case here. But they won't let you provide counsel to your loved one. Is that correct?
That's correct. You have a private attorney. The private attorney says, look, I need to be there. And they're like, no, you can proceed without your counsel. And you can give them 50 reasons, including mental issues and competency. And they're like, nope, you're competent to proceed. That's essentially what's happening here.
We just experienced that today, as a matter of fact, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
We did experience that. And I'm familiar with this going on for at least about 15 years. So that is a potential challenge that we would like to do, to establish that people who are here or serving any type of supervision from another state, that if you're going to be forcibly returned to your state, that you're going to have a due process that's required by the compact that we adopted. Our state legislature adopted it. We're party to it. It's a compact. It's like a treaty between states. They don't call it a treaty, but we've agreed to this. And if it's going to cost us too much money, maybe we need to withdraw from the compact, but and stop taking out of state offenders.
You're right. And one of the things that you pointed out repeatedly, too, is we have a bench book that basically is supposed to guide the courts here and tell them what to do. And part of that bench book says if somebody asks for counsel or has counsel, you should give it to them. And there are several other things, deadlines and other things that are in that bench book that are completely being ignored. So it is important that we get probable cause and due process and we establish a procedure here, because right now there is no mechanism for doing that. They're treating it as if it's on parole, and you have people that are on probation that have never actually even been on parole.
So we have another cause of action for, in order to get to that so-called period of parole, even though you've served all your time here, you'll serve your sentence minus your 15% good time if you're under what is that called? A serious aggravation. What do we call that? The classification?
Serious offenses. Violent offenses.
Serious SBO. Violent offenses. And then if you don't have one of those, you get 50% good time. But if after you've served that time, less your good time, if you've been fortunate enough not to have any of it forfeited, then you go into this period of indeterminate parole. And if you can't give an address to the parole board that they'll approve with all their phony stipulations that you can't be within 1,000 feet of everything, and they invent stuff. I mean, they've been telling people about school bus stops. You can't be there because they – and then they told one guy, there might be a school bus stop put there. So they wouldn't approve. So we have,
or there used
we
to have, be a pool, or there used to be a daycare, or there used to be something here, therefore you can't do that. Yeah, that's exactly what they're doing.
So we've got people who have a complete liberty interest. They paid their debt to society, and they're sitting in prison. Last count, over 300. Now, they're not all sexual offenders. The overwhelming majority of them are. But at last count, and I could get those by going through channels, 300 people sitting in prison because they cannot get an address that's approvable. So that is very high on our priorities, because these people should be out in the free world earning money and reunifying with their families.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're absolutely right. And that should not be, we don't do that for a lot of places. If you went before a lot of judges here and said, oh, they can't come out on probation or they can't come out on parole because they don't have a good address, we're just going to keep them in. Most of the judges here in New Mexico would actually balk until you get to this situation. And then all of a sudden it becomes important with all these stipulations. And I even heard one where they weren't going to release the person because the house that they wanted to be released to was dirty and their family wouldn't clean it for them. And they had no way to get out to clean it, so they couldn't have an acceptable address. So they stayed in. That's the kind of level of arbitrariness that we're dealing with here. And it's super important. You can't keep people in just because they can't provide an acceptable address past their sentence. You can't.
Well, we're doing it. We've been doing it for years. And to credit of former Corrections Secretary Marcantel under the previous administration, he tried with limited success they used to call it in-house parole. And he said, I want that word stricken from their vocabulary. He said, these are people that are release eligible. And even though they're release eligible, we haven't found a way to release them. And I think we're going to have a court decision that says on their day when they've maxed out their sentence, they will walk out the gate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your problem. If you don't like what the address they provide you, then you have to provide an address that you do like. But
right.
In the federal system, you walk out the gate on your release date. You don't continue to serve your time in federal prison. In general, you walk out before your release date because they give you some halfway, a small amount of halfway house time. But you do not sit in federal prison after you've done your time. But we've got that problem here. And We're gonna pause for just a moment before we go into the last couple, and we're gonna have that drum roll for the prize of conference registration to attend 2020. So, Andy, would you roll the drums, please?
Is that sufficient rolling? All right. So the number will be 9632. If you have 9632, shoot a text message over to 747-2277 and tell me that you are the winner, and we'll slot you to get in contact with you to relieve the to give you the prize.
Sound like there were some digits missing. Could you do the phone number one more time?
Oh, I could have, because I was thinking at the same time. 747-227-4477.
All right. So thank you. Now, if you're not here and we don't get a text shortly, we'll just pick another number. So you got to be listening to win something good. So that is a very high on our priority list. And then we have what's been talked about earlier, GPS monitoring. By statute, and I didn't look up the number, but by statute, we have a list of sexual offenses that must have this GPS monitoring. And I hate for people to say wear it, because you don't wear the damn thing. It's attached to you.
Yes.
But we have a statutory requirement that if you have been convicted of one of these particular offenses that is enumerated, that you will be monitored by GPS for the duration of your so-called parole, which could be 5 to 20 or 5 to life. And we've learned from case law out there that that's a search and seizure, and it can't be arbitrarily applied to everybody simply because they got convicted of that offense. I think the most recent case, favorable case, was out of the state of Massachusetts from the state Supreme Court there. So we want to shut that down and have that statute declared unconstitutional. And they're not going to stop doing it on their own volition. So that is high on our list of priorities. Is it as high as the people who are sitting in prison that have their liberty denied? Probably not quite as high as that, but it's very high that you're going to have everything about your life seized from you and have to pay a cost. And I think they're imposing a cost for that as well on the offenders. Not all of them, but I think they're, because we have in New Mexico, we have a sliding fee scale for your supervision costs. And I think those who, depending on where they are on that scale, they pay a higher supervision cost. It goes from 25 to 180 per month. And then they assess the GPS on the people who have higher incomes, if I'm not mistaken.
They're actually assessing the GPS cost on everyone that's on it, unless it is put on by a specialty court. And that's extremely rare. And that's a weird one-off situation. But their cost for the GPS, probation's cost is $150 a month, and they're passing at least $50 of that on to every single offender.
So not only do you get to undergo a search and seizure without any due process, you get to pay for the privilege of being searched and seized.
Correct. And they make you sign a contract when they put that GPS on you that you are obligated to pay that every single month.
So, wow. And then the other one, it may be something that will become crisper to us after the Miller versus Rankin decided. And that's in terms of the credit for time served on registries in other states. There's no credit provided in statute. So you can have a 17 years in Ohio, and you can come here and you can be properly a 20-year offender because you were off paper by July 1, 2005. And they'll tell you, sorry, those 17 years don't count. You got 20 years to do here.
Right. And then on top of that, the other issue, and I kind of understand this, but I still think it's kind of tied into it. So if you're on probation and let's say you're on a 10-year non-publishable here, your 10 years does not start until you end up at the end of probation. It doesn't start here. The thing is that you could have already been on probation for 20 years out of some of these other states, and you've already been on that registry for 20 years. And I know that's not the exact same issue, but I think it does tie into that there needs to be some credit for what you've already served on it.
And then it really comes into play for people, because originally we had registration enacted for people convicted on or after July 1, 1995. And then 5 years later, they changed it to include not only those who were convicted after July 1, 1995, but those who were on probation or parole or in prison as of July 1, 1995. So you had people who had been exiting the judicial system, filing out their numbers, leaving in 96, 97, 98, 99, 2000, up through July 1st of 2000. And then some of them went many, many years without being discovered because how often are you going to call them to say, I got convicted in 1998 and I'm just wondering if they might have passed a retroactive law that would apply to me. So these people went 10, 12 years in some cases and never had an obligation to register. They picked up an EWI, and when they got put into jail, their criminal history reflected, and they said, "Oh, you were in that group of people who we'd never caught up with. Congratulations, you get to register starting today." And we're arguing that if the theory of the case is going to be, and I haven't discussed this one with you, but the theory of the case is going to be that the state knew where they were the entire time, the last 12 years between the time the law was retroactively imposed on them, and they took no effort. They didn't use the voter rolls. They didn't use the DMV, the MVD, as we call it. They didn't use anything to try to contact these people. And therefore, no reasonable person is going to check every year and say, well, the legislature just adjourned. Now, I wonder, I got convicted in 98. Would they have done anything that would have affected me? I mean, no one in their right mind would do that. Because it would never occur to you that they would pass a retroactive law. So we believe that those people should get credit from the day that was imposed on them if they were in New Mexico all of that time and they were in databases that would have made the state easily able to notify them. And is that theory going to work? I don't know, but I know it won't work if we don't try it. And I think there's some equity issues there in terms of what we can argue. And the state has duty. The state knew where the people were. At least they had to utilize to find these people. And they just waited until they found them 10 years later, 15 years later, and said, oh, by the way, you got to register. And it's really ruined some people's lives that had thought they'd put this thing behind them.
Right.
So, well, we're going to take some questions. There's the Star 6, and it's open to the nation. We'd like to have some New Mexico callers, but didn't that many sign up? I don't know why. But Star 6 will get you in the queue. And while people are pressing their Star 6, did you have any personal comments or anything final you want to say before we start to the Q&A?
Just that I'm really excited with the stuff that we've already identified, and there's a bunch of other stuff that I know that we'll prioritize and keep chipping away at it. But I am really looking forward to us getting a list and starting and getting some quick wins, and then just keep moving forward and chipping away at this stuff. So I'm super excited about our relationship, Larry.
Well, I am as well, and I'm hoping our board is as excited as I am, because I don't think we would have this type of opportunity fall in our lap like we've had now, and we're going to try to capitalize on it. So let's see how many people want to talk to us. Well, oddly enough, there's actually someone in the queue. So Star 6 will get you in for questions. So area code 505, that would be New Mexico. You're in Northland Action with Ashley.
Hi, thank you so much for all of your work. I'm confused about the 1995 issue. So for someone who was convicted prior to 1995 in another state, and served all their time prior to that, what does that mean? What does that ruling mean?
It means if they had finaled out all of their obligations to that state prior to July 1, 1995, they would not be within the zone of registrability in New Mexico. And that means exactly what I just said. Every single day that you owed your state, not counting registration obligations, but anything related to your conviction that you owed the court in that state, if you final that out, you're not within a zone of registrability.
Okay, so the person that I'm talking about, all of that is true and has been registering for years in New Mexico and was told that he had to register in New Mexico. And we actually went to a lawyer and brought them all the information. And they, after paying him a lot of money, he also concurred that he, in fact, does need to register in New Mexico. So,
well, there's either something you're not telling me, or the lawyer did not know what they were talking about. Now, I'll let Ashley tell who does the bulk of the consulting around here about the sex offender stuff.
When they moved to New Mexico, when did their period of probation end? When were they completely done with their sentence?
I believe it was 1991.
Huh. Would be something we should probably look into, because as Larry stated, they shouldn't have to. It should have been excluded, because it should have been only people that were still having to you're completing probation at that point.
So what year did
we be in touch?
Yeah. I've got your number. I've got your number here. What year did this person move to New Mexico?
2000, I believe.
So moved in 2000. And what county are they registered in?
Now in Santa Fe County.
And who told them
but
that
it was
they had Bernalillo
that made the first determination?
So that would be our good friends locally here. All right. Well, it is quite possible that the attorney got it wrong, and it is very possible that DPS got it wrong. But my point was making is that the attorneys don't know this area of the law, and usually they come to me with their questions. So that's how Ashley and I met, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So we'll be in touch with you offline then. Is that?
Yes, if your number is the 281 number, yes, I've got it down here. All right.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Thanks for all your work, both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So star 6 will get you in the queue, and we have, I think this is one of our board members.
Yeah, your thinking is right. This is Rick Dean, Chair LJC, and I just wanted to welcome Ashley to our group and thank her for her enthusiasm and her passion, and look forward to working with you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Rick has been a very, very significant asset to the cause. And out in Torrance County, he's had to educate them in terms of what they can and cannot do. And they've not been as receptive initially, but then over the years, they've come to appreciate that he understands what they can and can't do. Would that be a nice way to put it? Would that be a nice way to describe it?
Well, yeah, it was able. They were actually appreciative because it was allowed them to streamline the process and have everything ready for each individual, and they knew what information each individual on which scheme had to give them what.
Rick,
so it was like a 15-minute cut down. They got to go back to eating donuts.
There's a Rick helped them understand that we have three different registration schemes, and what's required is different under each of the three schemes. And they were telling people that under scheme one, under version one, they had to do things they're not required to do. And Rick let them understand that they're not required to do the same things under version one that they're under version two and three. And the only thing I don't like about what Torrance County is doing, they tell everybody they set aside one day and they tell them you have to come in on a Sunday. Well, the hell with you people. I'll come in. I have other things to do on Sunday. That's an important day in my life that I don't want to come in. So I think that we could make an issue about that, but that's not been an issue. No one's really complained about it, but it would be an issue for me.
Yeah, well, it's between 7 and 11 on Sunday morning. That's why I say they got to get back to their donuts, and they're happy about it. And they don't give anybody a hassle. It's quick assembly line. Pop, 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 you're done. Before, it was a 30, 45-minute hassle.
Yeah, I've heard it's very efficient and streamlined out there, so we'll have to give them credit for that. So, well, all right. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Rick.
No problem.
We're going to the state of Colorado. Welcome to NARSL in Action, and you're on with Ashley.
Well, thanks, Larry. This is Roger. Just a comment on the importance of referring to the folks as a person who committed a sex offense rather than sex offender. And, you know, sex offender is present tense, and, you know, it's just incorrect, and I think it really puts a negative label, you know, on our folks.
Appreciate that, Roger.
You're welcome.
So, area code 505, we've had you on. Welcome again.
Hello there. I actually have a question. I've been listening. I do have some comments. It's really interesting what you guys are doing, and I would have signed up and made a contribution, but your website is down, I believe, tonight.
Let me address that. The website is under reconstruction because we're so excited of what we're doing. We want to be able to roll out a more friendly platform that will allow you to have more options available to you. And of course, we want you to give us money, but Rick is actually coordinating a rebuild of the website, and I can bring him back and he can tell us about what the status is. But yes, the website is under reconstruction.
Okay. I don't know if you guys need any help or not, but my background is I'm probably one of the few people you'll ever meet who's written a pro se 2255 and gotten a federal sex crime conviction vacated for due to actual innocence. I understand that things like that are pretty rare. And I pay a lot of attention to what's happening legally. You know, I spend time down at the law library and I really enjoy it. So if there's anything I can do, let me know. I'm retired, have a lot of energy, and maybe we can get in contact later.
I'm going to take your phone number down, and I never like to turn down offers for help. We'll be back in touch with you.
I can fetch and tote like with the best of them. So,
I remember, we get such a lot of inquiries, and particularly at the national level, but we get a fair number even at the state. We just can't do much with, and everybody will tell you they want to undo their conviction and they're innocent, and it'll go on for pages and pages and pages, and then the people will submit these petitions. And I remember one in Maryland where the guy submitted this. He'd done it pro se, and I looked at the thing and I said, well, it's pretty well written. I said, this thing might actually gain some traction, but it's a long shot. And sure enough, it gained some traction. The federal judge was very interested in it, and he asked the former chief public defender to take a look at it and see if she could help him, and he ended up getting off the registry. So anytime when people doing something themselves, if they have significant skills, we can probably put you to work. And I'll be in touch after the program.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I still have a second conviction. I'm actually still on federal supervised release for that one that wasn't vacated. But Judge Browning, federal Judge Browning, actually vacated a federal charge, a sex crime, because of my 2255. So I'm pretty excited about legal issues. And I have read, I've read many, many 2255 applications for various people when I was in prison. And a lot of what people write are just long shots, or just grasping at straws. And but sometimes you run onto ones that are have merit. So anyway, I don't want to take all your time. You probably got a long queue.
Well, what's your first name? And I'll put it with the number I wrote down here.
My first name is Ed.
Okay, Ed, thank you. And we'll use the phone number that you're coming in on. So, all right.
Okay.
Thanks.
Let you go a bit. I just wanted to thank you guys. Thanks, Ashley.
Thank you, Ed. We appreciate your help.
Star 6 will get you in the queue. It's actually thinned out to just a couple. So, area code 484.
Hi, Larry.
You are on with Ashley.
Hi, Larry. I was just asking a general question. There seems to be layers of restrictions, state restrictions, federal restrictions, down to where your own parole officer has his own restrictions. He has made people registrants put a camera in their household that they can monitor at any time on the telephone, his phone. Doesn't that seem rather invasive?
Well, I've never heard that one before.
Where is this at?
Yeah. Pennsylvania.
Huh.
It baffled me when I heard it. I mean, that seems to be a clear violation.
That's a new one on me too. I've never heard that.
Yeah, it's one of those things where people ask, can they do it? That's why we have that program periodically.
Right.
Yes, they can do it until they're stopped. And there's a lot of things when a person's a lot of things can be done when a person's under supervision, if it's specifically tailored to that offender and it does not deprive any more liberty than is necessary to achieve the purposes of that form of supervision. So it's not to say that it couldn't be done lawfully, but it couldn't be done without some precision applying to some specific uniqueness of that offender. You can't just start telling about it, we're going to put a camera in your house because we'd like to see what you're doing.
Right.
But, of course, it would be real – it would be really hard for me to imagine what you would have to, how high the hurdles would need to be to justify invading someone's privacy at that level. Now, what the argument would be, well, if they were in prison, they would have cameras on them all the time there. So that's a pretty high invasion of privacy. So if they're in a type of supervision where it's an alternative to prison, they would otherwise be in prison, and there was a specific need for protection, you might could get away with it. But I would sure like to fight that if it were in my jurisdiction here.
Are there other people in the household?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Are there other people in the household?
Yeah, my wife and myself, and the father and mother. It doesn't make much sense, but we hope we don't get to that point, because he's been discharged by the state of Pennsylvania and let free, and then all of a sudden he's got 4 years of probation in the county. I don't know where that comes from, but it would seem to me if the letter says Pennsylvania is done with you, can a county assert a certain right over and above the state?
We would have to know more about that, but back to the camera thing, I would actually, as the other household members, might have a good standing to not have that in there.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Larry and ma'am, and thanks so much.
Thank you for
letting us know.
Thank you for what you do for us. Thank you. The queue is actually empty, and we've got 3 minutes to go. So if anybody wants to quickly get in the queue, *6. If not, we're going to wrap up here. So Ashley, did you have anything that you want to impart to us in the way of wisdom in terms of today's events?
Just that I appreciate everybody, all the questions. I appreciate all the input, and I do appreciate everything that everybody does out there. We're going to keep fighting it. It may not be as fast as anybody likes, but we are going to keep fighting it, just so you know.
And we hope to have you. We haven't mentioned your injury, but poor Ashley, in her final 2 weeks at the DA's office, fell and broke your what?
I shattered my humerus, which wasn't very humorous.
And your humerus is a what? What does that do?
The bone that goes right up into your shoulder, I shattered it so that it's just shoved up in there. And it had to be my right arm. Couldn't have been my left arm. Had to be my right arm.
Well, that's probably because you were trying to break the fall.
I don't think I did much breaking of the fall. I just fell. But yeah, fell right onto it.
And so therefore, your recovery is still underway. And you have limited ability to produce work product. But your thinking has not been impaired, just your physical ability has been a little bit impaired.
Just my typing skills, yep.
We've had some intense conversations about strategy, and we're going to get more and more into strategy. But folks in New Mexico, and even across the country, if this model works, if we can perfect this particular model, if we can do enough litigation where we can collect fees, because we know in our little tiny population, we're never going to raise the type of money it would take to provide for the funding. So we're going to have to be a little bit mercenary and choose those cases where we can win. Every injustice won't be able to be addressed with a part-time staff attorney. But if we can win some, that will allow us to undertake some really worthwhile causes without having to be so mercenary about those. And it's going to be a careful balancing between what we can do. And they will never be the type of crap that they can throw at us will never end. There will always be a need for litigation. I mean, have you looked at that behavioral contract over the years and watched how it's in, how they've added to it each and every year?
Yes.
I mean, stuff that we couldn't have imagined they've put into the behavioral contract, and it keeps expanding on things you can't do. And it's like, what will they think of next? Well, we don't know until they think of it. But they will not run out of creativity in terms of trying to make the offender suffer, and that's what it's all about. They're determined to make life as miserable and have as many people fail as they possibly can. Sorry to say that, but that's what it is here.
Yes, it is.
And that's not the way it should be, but that's the way it is.
No, they'll tell you that everything is in furtherance of rehabilitation and that they're there for success. But no, the reality is they're there to make you fail and send as many people back as possible. And that's just sad to me.
Oh, Well, we've got a respectable crowd still here. We're going to wrap it up for this session of the phone call of the Arsenal in Action program. Mr. Producer, did you have any announcements you need to make in terms of the Registry Matters podcast coming up this weekend?
It should be something pretty spectacular with all the news that's been going on lately with a particular very wealthy individual out of Florida. It should be pretty exciting.
Gee, you're not gonna force me to talk about that, are you?
I'm not gonna force you to do anything that you don't want to do, sir.
Any closing comments from you, Ashley? If not, we're gonna sign off. Andy's gonna play my farewell song here.
None from me. Thank you, everyone, and thank you, Larry and Andy, for having me on here, and Andy, all your help with the technical stuff. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
Well, we hope to have you as a regular. I really appreciate it. I can get crisp and concise answers, and some of our attorneys go on and it's really nice when I can get short. I remember I was so shocked. You remember when the Pennsylvania attorney gave me a yes answer, and I said, "Is that it?" She said, "Yes, that's the answer to your question." So how often do you get a yes answer out of an attorney when you ask a question, when you got a yes or no? That's rare.
I didn't even know that
yes
was an
or no
vocabulary.
Answer out of King.
Thanks everyone, and we hope to make these more regular, and I think Ashley will be a regular guest if she's able and has time. And so long for this episode, and thank everyone, and you've been listening to Arsenal in Action.
Thank you. Good night, everyone.
Good night, Ashley.